This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and Boston Mayor Marty Walsh joins us now from Mondays with the Mayor. He'll take some of your calls a little later on at 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Mayor Walsh, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Mayor Walsh, we've got a lot to cover today. I want to talk about the coronavirus. I'd love to chat about the holidays a little. There's some stuff we want to talk about on policing and the police body camera images that came out last Friday. But I just want to start. It's been a little while since we've talked with you. How are you? How you doing?
I'm doing good. You know, it's been, I think it's challenging for a lot of people. I think that, you know, this year from February till today, there's lots of emotion. People are worried about, you know, when the virus is going to end. They're worried about their job. They're worried about their business. They're worried about people's health, their own health. And it's been a really complicated, stressful year. And I just encourage everyone listening today that, you know, if you need to talk to somebody, make sure you do. That's not said enough. I mean, we're going to get into some pretty heavy issues here today. And there's a lots of emotion around them. But I just encourage people. I try to do it at my press conferences. It's really important to find outlets to be able to talk to people. We'll get through this. You know, the people of Boston and Massachusetts and this country, quite honestly, have been remarkable throughout this year. You know, starting in February with the beginning of the coronavirus, and then November, the election, and then after the election, the President Trump refusing to basically acknowledge the fact that Joe Biden won and Kamala Harris won, and we're heading into a new year in 2021, and I hope it's, you know, we'll see. There's going to be better days ahead.
You know, I share your hope with that, Mayor Walsh. I really do. We've got about 10 days left in 2020, and I will be happy to put it behind us and
start 2021.
Oh, my God. Of all
the years, I mean, you wake up in 20 when the clock turns new year, you're excited about the new year. And unbeknownst to any of us, did we think that we'd be shutting everything down in society, from schools to businesses to even you? I'm not sure if you're in the studio or not, but, like, we're all doing people doing work from home. And it's, think about that for a minute. Like, that camaraderie that we don't have, that getting together, that talking, it's been really stressful for a lot of people. But we'll get through it.
Yeah. Mayor Walsh, you said we had some heavy stuff to talk about today, and we do. And I do want to start there so that we can then move on to COVID and maybe some holiday stuff as well. You know, the top of mind, I think, is the footage that came out involving the Boston Police Department. It came out last Friday. It was about 66 hours of body camera footage from the demonstrations that took place in late May following the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. There are a set of these clips that came out in a report from the appeal that show police officers spraying protesters, sometimes in their faces while the protesters have their hands up, using batons to push people down. A little later, we'll talk a little more about one where an officer appears to be bragging about hitting people with his vehicle. You did release a statement on this. You said on Friday that the tapes were difficult to watch. And I wanted to ask you, when you watched them, in your mind, were you thinking, I'm looking at one-off behaviors that were captured on film, or I'm looking at something that is indicative of regular policing for some subset of the Boston Police Department?
No, I was looking at one-off behavior, and there were situations there throughout the whole night. If you saw the footage right before that, it shows the officer driving through a crowd, having bricks and things thrown at the car. That night of the demonstrations, unfortunately, they turned violent. We had 9 officers taken to the hospital, dozens treated for injuries. We had lots of emotion out there. But what I saw on the video, that's why it was turned over to Internal Affairs to have an investigation. These types of situations are exactly why we're implementing body cameras for all police officers. And I think that, you know, the one thing that this was captured on a body camera, so it's good to have the body cameras out there. We also put together a police reform task force after that night, committed to bringing necessary reforms and accountability out there, which is also good. And, you know, we're through these reforms that we're instituting, and also we instituted an internal affairs oversight panel for Boston Police Department. And we're also reviewing our police accountability language. So all of this stuff is not necessarily in response to just what happened that night, but really what happened with George Floyd being killed. And, you know, and officers were hurt that night, and it got way out of control. I mean, I was in this weekend. I was down on Newbury Street, and, you know, some of the business owners were upset with us because people were breaking into their stores and looting, and people felt that no one's going after them. I was in Nordstrom's, and they showed us where people were stealing stuff, and the people in that store felt that, you know, where's the investigation there? So there's been a lot of emotion here. That's why when I opened up the conversation about all these emotions, there's lots of emotions. But, you know, we all have to do better, and when I, you know, the task force was set out to do some important work here. They did some really good work here. We're going to be implementing. We implemented some already. We're going to continue to implement. And we just have to continue to strengthen our police department in the sense of building trust. And that's what we're going to do.
So let's talk about that, especially the trust building. You talk about, you know, this needs investigation. And Boston Police Commissioner William Gross condemned it and said that it needs to be investigated, the behavior shown on this footage. One of the things I found myself thinking this weekend, Mayor Walsh, we knew that was a controversial night. You just talked about talking to business owners the next day. We knew that there was police body camera footage. Was no one reviewing this footage in the early days of June after the events?
I can't speak to that. So an investigation will come now. I'm sure they were looked at. I don't know. I can't answer that question. That's a question I have to ask, talk to the commissioner about, and see exactly what they're doing. I know that I think there's more than probably 66 hours of body camera footage. Maybe there's hundreds of cameras out there. I don't have the answer to that question, but I do know, like, you know, we're gonna look at this particular case, and any complaints that came in against police officers, we're gonna look at. But again, I think that we have to continue to the work of the reform task force that we put out there, and we're gonna continue to work to strengthen our police department with use of force policies. We're going to strengthen our work, our police department with the way that they operate. All of these things were brought up into the task force. One of the things that you
advanced in your police reform work and is also on the table with the police reform legislation that's still going back and forth at the State House, although Senate President Karen Spilka today said that they were going to bring it back to the governor again, is this question of civilian oversight of police behavior. This investigation, and I want to ask you to help me understand this, right now this investigation will be an internal investigation conducted by the police force. So the first question is, am I correct in my understanding on that? And then the second question is, given that there's a push to do civilian bodies to do some of this oversight, are you satisfied that you'll get the investigation you want if it's done internally in the police force?
Absolutely. I mean, if there's wrongdoing here, the officer will be held accountable if they find wrongdoing. And then also with the new policy, there will be still internal investigations going on subsequent to the civilian review board. So this is not just going to be one side, meaning looking at it. The Internal Affairs Division looks at the use of force and misconduct, alleged misconduct by police officers, and there's constantly penalties being given out. There's been terminations given out over the years. And, you know, all of those still stay in effect, but the Civilian Review Board will have an opportunity to look at these cases. And then we also have a board, the formerly co-op board, they're going to have a chance to look at 100% of the internal cases as well. So they subsequently can be looking at the cases, and that's civilians as well, looking at the cases in internal affairs.
Mayor Walsh, you said in your statement after the camera footage came out that some of it was difficult to watch. What was difficult about it?
What's difficult. I mean, I'm not going to put on the spot like this. You know exactly what's difficult. When you hear people talking police officers talking like that to people, I mean, I know it's in the heat of the moment, but, you know, we have to, unfortunately, in a situation like that, you have to be professional. And I understand that's the job people are trained for. That's the job you're trained for as a police officer, and sometimes you can't let emotion get to you, and you can't be making statements like that. That's just not what police officers do. You're brought into a situation to try and defuse a situation. Now, that night's a little different, obviously, because there's thousands and thousands of people out there, but you still have to be the reasonable voice in that situation.
You know, actually, Mayor Walsh, I know it might have felt like I was trying to put you on the spot there, but it was helpful to me to hear you say that, to frame out sort of the type of conduct and the expectation that you have, as you say, when emotions are very high, understanding what it is we expect of our law enforcement and how they're going to interact with the public and what you expect, I think is helpful. I think it's helpful for citizens. So what do you hope will result from investigations and examination here? What do you want to have come next?
I mean, I think what we have to do is continue to work. I mean, listen, people get emotional in a situation like that. people were scared that night. There was lots of scared people, including some officers that were scared. When you drive through a crowd and the people are throwing bricks and sticks and want to get to you, nine officers were taken to the hospital that night. That night was, we haven't seen, in my time as mayor and probably for the last 25 years, we've never really seen a night like that in Boston and around the country. It wasn't just Boston, it was around the country. And I've talked to my colleagues around the country, mayors around the country, talking about that those situations and how do we better prepare our police departments and how do we kind of honestly better prepare people in general. I mean, I think a lot of people, again, let's not lose sight of the reason why people were out that night. They were out because they were in response to George Floyd being killed. It went into systemic racism. It went into situations of you know, disparities for decades and decades and decades in Boston, in the country. So there was lots and lots of emotion there. And, you know, this issue of police accountability in that particular case is really important for us, and that's why there's an investigation. But just also subsequent to that, we put together the task force to look at this behavior and to look at policing. But we also are doing other things. We also declared racism a public health crisis. We also are working in our procurement laws. We're also working in some of the things that I've done since I've become mayor. So it's a lot deeper than policing, and it's a systemic problem that we have to work on.
So have you had conversations over the weekend with, for example, leaders of the Black community in Boston on rebuilding trust, on their reactions to police behavior in this footage
that
night?
I've been having conversations with people since March, and since when I became the mayor of Boston. I mean, it's an ongoing conversation. It never stops. You know, I've had many conversations with organizations such as NAACP, with Urban League. I've also had conversations with individuals, people calling me saying, you know, this video is concerning to me, and I talk to them, employees that work with me. I mean, I spend lots and lots of hours talking about these situations because it's important for me to hear it, listen, and as I continue to lay down, hopefully what we continue to do change and evolve as a police department or as a city, we have to continue to do that. So I have these conversations all the time.
You probably know that Larry Calderoni, the head of the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association, has pushed back on the video footage and the report from the appeal, saying, you know, the defense attorney only gave snippets. They were out of context, that we're not getting the full picture. You've talked a lot today about the experiences that police officers had that night, and, you know, concern that they were also receiving some violence, in your words, in pushback from people who turned out. And let's review the outlay of that day. Peaceful protests. None of the conflict began until after sunset. What is the overall story, Mayor Walsh, of that day, that night, the police response, and where we are now?
I don't quite understand what the overall story means, but I think that, again, we put together a police reform task force that came back with recommendations. They were given full authority to basically, you know, look at different areas of policing and how to make reform changes. We've accepted all of their recommendations. Some of it we instituted through the Civilian Review Board. We just, executive order, created it instantly at their recommendation. We also had some legislation that's gone to the City Council. We also have some work that we have to do internally in our own, the police department has to do some work creating data dashboards and as far as the transparency and having greater transparency. So we've been constantly working at this for quite some time now, from really when the task force was created to the recommendations came back. We also have a piece of legislation looking at preference for Boston graduates. We're creating an Office of Accountability and Transparency within the Boston Police Department. We're putting in new systems for diversity, inclusion, and community relations. Some of that is already there, and some of it we're going to build upon that work. This is it's a system that will make us, I believe, a national leader on the issue of policing. We are working productively with the City Council as we continue to move forward here. And I'm also working to reach our goals. We're working with the state partners to see what they do up at the state level. So there's multifaceted areas of reforms and changes that need to happen. And, you know, we haven't run away from it. I haven't run away from it. And we're going to continue to do it. I mean, again, we're going to do everything we can. A lot of people in the city love the police department. They love the work they do. They're doing, at this time of year, they do lots of good things. So, again, I think we have work to do because the officers that do the good stuff, I mean, we don't want to have them labeled as somebody who are obstructionists and causing troubles, because most of the officers go to work every day and do their job and try to get home at night safe and sound and not injured, so back to their families, because their fathers and their mothers and their sisters and brothers and uncles and aunts.
So before we go to the break, I do want to ask you a couple more questions, and then we'll take a break. The first is, in hearing you there, and you just told me a minute ago, you've been talking to leaders in Boston's Black community really since the beginning of your election. I know you know that there's some pain after these videos last Friday. What is your message today to those who had a painful and angry response to what they saw? What do you want them to hear from you?
You know, I just want everyone to know that we're working extremely hard on this. When I saw the video too, it bothered me, obviously, and you know, I cringed as well. And, you know, first thing I did was call the commissioner to talk about what the steps were on his behalf. And he had informed me at that point the officer was put on administrative leave that before I even got a chance to call him. And certainly it bothered me. I mean, people need to be able to – people should trust the police. And I know a lot of people don't, and a lot of trust has to be built, and it's not going to be done overnight, but we have to do that. I mean, we have to really make sure that we build trust out there, because they do serve a purpose of keeping people safe. And, again, that night was a very challenging night, particularly of what happened after I don't want to say when the sun went down, but later in that night, it was a very dangerous night out in the streets of Boston. It was dangerous for people that were out there peacefully protesting. It was dangerous for police officers. It was dangerous for a whole host of folks. It was dangerous to the people on all sides. And we don't need to have a repeat of that. What we need to do is build trust.
So to that end, part of the conversation around law enforcement and public safety reform has been about diversifying our public safety departments. And I know that the fire department has been an area of focus for you. And you announced over the weekend that you've got a bill to create a cadet program within the Boston Fire Department to diversify firefighters. It's now on Governor Charlie Baker's desk. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Yeah, it's a bill that we filed. It got approval by the legislature on Friday. This bill would create a cadet program within the Boston Fire Department, an effort to diversify the fire department. It would allow qualified residents of Boston between the ages of 18 and 25 to be appointed as a cadet by the Boston Fire Chief. After completing a two-year program and passing the civil service exam, a cadet would then have an opportunity to become a firefighter. It's modeled after the Boston Police Department's cadet program, which has seen significant success. It's a victory for our communities to an equitable Boston. We're going to continue to take steps to create opportunities for all Bostonians to make sure that they have an opportunity to serve as firefighters and represent the residents of the city of Boston they serve. So I'd like to give a special shout out to Representative China Tyler, the House sponsor, the Speaker of the House, Bob DeLeo, and Senate President Karen Spilka for their advocacy and having this bill go through before the session ends.
We're going to open up the phones. 1-800-423-8255 is the phone number. As we talk now with the mayor about the coronavirus, Mayor Walsh, I know the city has opened some additional free mobile testing sites in Hyde Park, Roxbury, Jamaica Plain. These sites are open to anyone regardless of symptoms. How many people are, do you know who you're hoping to reach with this expansion, and what do you want people to know about it?
Well, our daily positive test rate for the last 7 days has been 433 people. Our current community positivity rate, this excludes colleges, is 7.9%. All the number of neighborhoods above 7% in the city, above 8% in the city of Boston is seven neighborhoods. And our average daily testing, we're doing about 5,098 tests a day. So we're trying to get as many people tested as positive as possible, I should say. What we want to do is get a feel for where we are in the city, an accurate number with the virus. I'm a little concerned about our hospitalization right now in the city, and so we need to make sure that we do everything we can to get this virus number down. We're certainly seeing numbers that reflect back in May and June right now, and doesn't appear to be going down at this particular moment, so we're going to do everything we can to try and get this virus down. The experts have said that the months of January, February could be the worst of the pandemic, so that's certainly alarming to me and to us, so we have to do everything we can to until the vaccination comes, we have to do everything we can to get these numbers down.
You know, a couple of months ago, you were urging Bostonians to get tested twice a month, and you were sort of towards the front of cities that were looking at testing as more of a almost like a life maintenance strategy. Governor Baker, you know, sounded the alarm again today that we could be facing even more of a surge with this next wave of holiday season upon us. Are you still hoping Bostonians will get tested twice a month? Is that the number you're looking for? And are you feeling like that will get you to a ability to manage the curve?
At the very least, we'd like to see people get tested twice a month, if at all possible, on a weekly basis. I know that we're trying to do everything we can to open up access to testing. And, you know, we're also looking at how do we expand testing as much as possible in the city of Boston. I mean, that's the only place, the only way it's going to give us an accurate number. We can monitor a lot with knowing what the positivity rate in the city of Boston is. We can manage how we interact with business and society. We also can keep an eye on our hospitalization. That's one of the biggest concerns I have. When we scaled back a week ago to step two, phase two, it was really looking at the hospitalization numbers getting higher and higher. And we need to make sure that these beds are available for not just coronavirus patients, but also non-coronavirus patients.
So that step two, phase two, it was in first phase, like 3 weeks, and then you will revisit, which is early January. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's true. Yep.
So you just said hospitalization was kind of the trigger number. So what will you be looking for around January 4th when you reconsider what would allow you to move forward again with the reopening?
We're going to be looking at metrics such as what our daily testing is, testing positive rate is. We're going to be looking at a seven-day average, see where our average is. We're going to be looking at community data, and we're going to be looking at hospitalization capacity, both ICU beds and non-surge ICU beds. Non-ICU beds being occupied.
And do you feel, Mayor Welsh, like we're in a better position to handle these surges now than we were in the spring? You know, one of the things that we've noticed is that, fortunately, the mortality rates have not grown in the same way they did in the spring as infection rates grew.
Yeah, that's the one thing that's changed, at least in what we're talking about today. But, you know, there's a report coming out of London that the virus has, you know, different strands of the virus, and it's more contagious. And obviously, we have to watch that to see what's going on there. So, you know, it's kind of watching what's happening in other parts of the world, other parts of the country, and monitoring it here so we can act appropriately. I'd like to say we're in a better place. I think we're in a better place because people aren't as sick and going into hospital on ventilators, but we still have people going into hospital on ventilators, and that's kind of, you know, we're still in this uncertain area right now.
So
that's
you're
why
leading
it's really
a group
important
of
for people to, you know, physical distance, social distance, wear masks for the holidays. I'd ask people, you know, I know it's the holiday season and we all want to be with our loved ones, but I'd ask people just to stay with your immediate household. This is not the season to be traveling and having gatherings in your home. You just don't know. And if somebody tests negative for the coronavirus, that shouldn't give anyone type of like, oh, we can meet together now. We really should limit it to the family unit that you're around all the time for this year. I mean, we want to keep people safe and healthy.
You know what, let's dive into that for just a second, Mayor Walsh, because, you know, I know over the summer you put out a photo of visiting your mom, and it was really moving. You had your hands against the glass. She had hers. My mother has passed away, but I haven't seen my father in over a year because it's not safe to go home and see him. And we know that both the call is for people not to see their family members over the holidays, and that we learn from Thanksgiving, some families are simply saying, that's a deal breaker. We have to see each other. How do you think about the mental health balance of that? And how do you advise people who are thinking about the pain it will be not to see their loved ones?
I think at the end of the day, it's about keeping them safe and healthy, and it's about individuals being safe and healthy. And as I said in the beginning of this, it's been a really trying year for everybody. And you know, we have a couple more months to go here before the vaccine is widely available. This is not the time to let the guard down and just, you know, let the emotion take over. I know it's brutal to say this and hard to say this, but you want to keep your loved ones safe. You want them to be around for, you know, the holidays for next year. And I would just advise everyone, please be careful. This virus is contagious. People are still dying. People are dying with the virus. The country has gone over the 300,000 person mark in the United States for people that have died of coronavirus. So it is still taking people's lives. And I would just ask everyone to be careful. I mean, I don't want to be be the person on the radio all the time saying, you know, don't visit your family and don't go out and don't do this and don't go out to eat. And I mean, I don't want to do that. I mean, I want to open things up. I want businesses to be thriving. I want people to be happy. I want people to be working. But this virus is a global pandemic, and it's taking people's lives, and it's causing lots of harm. We don't even know what the impacts are going to be long-term of people that have had serious bouts of coronavirus. We have no idea what the long-term impacts are of it. So I think that we're best bet is to try and not be part of a statistic saying, you know, you had coronavirus and these are the implications later on down the road. This is still a very new virus. I've talked to epidemiologists, I've talked to scientists, I've talked to doctors, and they're still in the early stages of learning about this virus in the beginning.
Mayor Walsh, we've got a caller. We've got Gershon on the line from Charlestown. Gershon, go ahead.
Hi, Marty. Firstly, thanks for taking the coronavirus seriously. You know, obviously, there's been people in other states and cities that haven't. My question is, I'm a gym owner, and we know from the science that gyms contribute a 0.04 to 0.06% spread. So firstly, I'm not sure why we've been rolled back for this three-week period. And also, obviously, because the gyms across Massachusetts haven't been shut, people can move who might normally come to my gym can go to a gym in Medford or Malden. So I'm not sure exactly how this policy is going to be effective in reducing the spread. And I'd just like you to explain the science behind your answers. Thank you.
No, thank you very much for the call, and thank you, and sorry for what's had to happen here. Boston is a population center. Lots of people come in and out of our city every day. You know, we've made the decision to go further. We've had about seven other cities and towns join us in going further. It's not necessarily about what's spread at what function or what's not spread at certain, whether it's a gym or a museum or a movie theater. What we're doing is we're cutting back on activity out in the streets, what we're trying to do. And we're doing a three-week period here to see if the numbers go down. I'm hoping the numbers do go down. I think there could be a need at some point for further pullback and further restrictions. We're not at that point at this particular moment, but within a matter of a week, we could be in that situation. The virus numbers have not gone down. Many people have brought this to my attention. You know, gyms are not a spreader. You know, there's lots of industry that's not spreading, but ultimately what we have to do is cut back on certain activities in the city of Boston so that we have less people out and about.
And Mayor Walsh, you're calling on the state legislature to provide some financial relief to business owners. Is that right?
Yeah, there's a bill, economic development bill right now that's in conference committee, and there's a $49 million financial package there. I asked, you know, because of the previous caller, I'm getting calls from gym owners and restaurant owners and people calling that are saying, you know, we're about to go out of business. What's the plan? And, you know, we've been able to allocate about $26 million in the city of Boston to go to small businesses and different types of relief. But that $49 million is money that can hit the streets now. And then the federal government's about, I think they're going to vote on today, a package that's worth $900 billion. That's going to help small businesses, people on unemployment insurance. So, I mean, this virus has touched every single person. There's really nobody, no industry that this has not touched. And so the relief has to come to help these businesses.
In our remaining time, we have talked about some tough stuff today, Mayor Walsh. It is Christmas week. We are in the holidays. Is there anything that's going to give you some joy and some relief and a break at the end of the week this week? How are you going to celebrate?
You know, I know this has been a really, really difficult year for a lot of people. And I just want you to know, like, we'll get through this. People of our city and our state and this country have been amazing, supporting and helping each other. We've come a long way. This has been a really long year. I'm just asking people to just dig down a little deeper for a couple more months here, and there is light at the end of the tunnel, and take care of yourself and take care of your families. That's ultimately, at the end of the day, what I want to be able to tell people, just continue to support each other. I mean, it's kind of counterproductive for a mayor of a city or a governor of a commonwealth of a state telling people don't go outside and don't intermingle, but none of us ever expected a global pandemic. When I got elected in 2013, probably the last thing that I thought I'd have to deal with was a global pandemic, and here we are today.
Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Just 10 days left in 2020, and you may be celebrating. Seems like many are happy to say goodbye to the year. But while those days remain, we want to use them to review this kind of one-of-a-kind year we've had across a number of subjects: medicine, music, sports. Last week, we talked movies. Today, it's social media. And we invite you to join the conversation. What characterized social media for you this year? How do you think history is going to judge the role of social media in 2020? What do you want or expect from social media platforms in 2021, whether that's in content, regulation? Join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got a couple great guests to chat with us on this. We have Joan Donovan, Research Director of the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School, and Kimberly Atkins, Senior Opinion Writer at the Boston Globe and former colleague. Joan, Kimberly, welcome back to the show.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have both of you. So in preparing for this conversation, producer Walter Wuthman and I talked a lot about what we kind of thought maybe the headline from the year in social media might be. And later I will tell you, but I want to start by asking that of each of you first. Joan, what's the social media headline for 2020?
Oh my goodness. It's quite a question. I was going back and looking all the way back to January, where we started and where we are. And I think we've got system failure, you know, so that would be my broad headline. That would be my one shot.
What about you, Kimberly?
I think it's the fight over accountability. You know, there was a lot of, it was no question that what was happening in a lot of ways was not good and was not working, but very few answers about exactly who is accountable for it and what can be done to fix it.
So listeners, what about you? What is the headline for social media in 2020? 1-800-423-8255 to join that conversation. All right, so I'll tell you, Walt and I were thinking that it had to do with the social media headline this year being the year that conspiracy went mainstream. Is this the year that conspiracy went mainstream, Joan?
I think I would agree with you. There's a question that I've been trying to explore in the research around, is this actually a feature of social media systems in general, that they move the fringe closer to the mainstream and therefore distort reality, especially as a lot of journalism begins with almost as if Twitter trending topics is their assigning editor. if you can make something trend, you can make it true in some instances.
Kimberly, you know, we've talked to you over the years from DC covering the court, covering public policy, covering the legislature. Are you seeing conspiracy theories entering the policy discussion in a way that surprises or alarms you this year coming out of social media?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the way, look, conspiracy theories, of course, are not in any way new. But what used to happen in the past is once myths and conspiracy theories were debunked, they would just stop getting attention in mainstream media organizations, whether it's newspapers or television. You just wouldn't hear much about them, and that would help them get shut down. A great example of that was the anti-vaccine movements of in the 90s and early 2000s had kind of started to pick up speed, but then once, you know, journals and medical journals started shooting it down, the media stopped paying attention to it. Well, they found a home on social media because you don't have that sort of gatekeeper that's going to stop them. And that led to the rise of that movement. The very same thing with some of these political conspiracy theories, which frankly just sound preposterous. But when given enough space on social media and when connected, when you have people who believe in them connecting to one another worldwide on social media, you certainly get a groundswell. And of course, you had the help this year with the person with the biggest platform, arguably, of them all, the President of the United States, retweeting or pushing some of these conspiracy theories. And that just helped them to catch fire.
You know, in listening to the two of you, putting that whole picture together, especially that last part you just said, Kimberly. So now we have a tweeter in chief who is constantly active on a platform that is widely criticized, Twitter, for not doing a good enough job to mitigate false content. announces real policy, real announcements from the White House that have important daily implications, including firings, resignations, you know, executive orders, et cetera, but then also traffics in conspiracy. Joan, does that make it impossible for us not to equate false content and conspiracy theories with real policy and real content when they're juxtaposed and driven by that powerful one person?
Undoubtedly. And as I think about this issue, what I've been drawn to is to try to understand the scale. And when we first really started dealing with misinformation post the 2016 election, it was a lot of, trying to understand the information ecosystem, trying to look at the role of automation and in making it look like there was a groundswell of attention to specific issues. We started to tilt our moderation policies on different platforms towards getting rid of bots and automated content. But as that was happening, the way in which misinformation was traveling through and across other platforms started to change. And as it changed, we became less concerned with anonymously run fake news sites and more concerned with what we call white propaganda, that is propaganda where we know its source. And the way in which Trump had utilized his Twitter account in particular was like a circumvention strategy. That is, he was constantly undermining the press who were trying to fact check everything that he said. And then in the same breath, you'd also have to, as a journalist, come back with, oh yeah, and what he said about the development of a vaccine is true, right? And so it does cause massive confusion for the public when the press is called in to deal with someone who is really utilizing and exploiting the openness of social media platforms to do disinformation at scale.
So then let's talk about the platforms themselves. And listeners, 1-800-423-8255, how are you feeling about the accountability level of the platforms themselves? Facebook, Twitter, Parler, TikTok, is this a time for regulation, or are these places where information should roam free depending on how people want to curate it for themselves and what they want to say? Where do you think the lines ought to be drawn? 800-423-8255 again is that number. Kimberly, this was also a year where it seemed like the zeitgeist, that might not be the right word, but I'm sticking with it, around our attitude towards social media platforms went from cheerleader and, you know, in the case of Facebook at one point, hero worshiping, right, to feeling and being more critical of the role that they're playing in our society. How did you see that play out?
Oh, I think that's absolutely the case. I mean, social media started out as a way to sort of democratize information. If you know, everybody had a voice and everybody could express themselves in a way that the gatekeepers of traditional media would not allow, and it was seen as this really useful and great tool. But again, as disinformation and fomenting of really awful things in our society really took hold of the medium, we saw a lot of the problems that turn up when you don't have a gatekeeper, when you don't have anybody saying this cannot be on the platform or this can. And so we've seen a turn up of pressure on the leaders of these social media companies to alter their behavior, to implement policies that would prevent this sort of thing, and a real resistance from those like Mark Zuckerberg, the head of Facebook, who are saying that is not their job, that they are a platform, they are not a traditional medium, they are not a utility, they are just a platform for other people to express themselves, and to put that burden on them would essentially kill the effectiveness of those medium. There's also money being driven by this, right? You have Facebook that is acquiring other big social media companies. It bought Instagram, it bought WhatsApp, and now there is an antitrust action by the federal government and state attorneys general saying that it got too big in that way, and it's exerting its power in an anti-competitive way. It's just showing that there is really no legal or social mechanism in place to really hold these companies accountable. These aren't, it's not like Ma Bell in the 1980s yeah. that was broken up into the Baby Bells. It's an entirely different thing. And you have folks here in Washington that are trying to figure out, and in states, trying to figure out exactly what tools they can use to sort of hold it accountable when none of them really fit perfectly.
Let's grab a call here. We've got Steve on the line from Cambridge at the number 800-423-8255. Steve, go ahead.
Hey, my biggest gripe is the blue check verification. I mean, what are the standards for accreditation? And they themselves don't even follow it. So, you know, the blue check thing, either everyone gets on board, or like everyone gets in bed, or everyone sleeps on the floor, because they don't even follow their own standards. And you amplify these voices for people who don't, you know, they don't even follow the standards.
Thanks for that, Steve. So, Joan, I put Steve's mm-hmm. call with what we just heard from Kimberly. Are we at a time when there must be regulatory enforcement, even of just the basic standards that the platforms say they're going to stick to themselves, or at a higher level like Kimberly was talking about, you know, Washington looking at?
It's a great question. I think that there's no way that they can actually implement their terms of service because of the sheer scale of their networks. And they didn't really focus a lot on building curation tools. And to the question about, well, what does the blue check actually mean? When blue checks arrived, it's because anyone could sign up as anybody else. I could show up and be Donald Trump. This is actually why Donald Trump's name says real Donald Trump, because there were fake ones running around on the platform. And so blue check only means one thing, which is that the company has received verifying information that you are who you say you are. And they've limited that even because they can't do it for every user because it would overrun their systems. They do it for celebrities and newsworthy individuals who may be confused by other people in the public. And so the blue check doesn't really denote anything other than the company has verified that person's identity. But when it comes to standards, we do need to raise the standards in a similar way to how journalism professionalized, to say, well, we're going to have some rules about how we deal with sources. We're going to have some rules for how we deal with non-public individuals. And we're going to have a code of ethics that we hold each other to. And I think that as we understand what social media standards may be in the future, I think that there needs to be a broad public conversation about what things we are willing to allow and what things are going to be considered harmful to the public health and well-being of our society.
So, Joan, I think we have a caller who might push back on that a little. And just before I go to Dara, listeners, last question for you is, are you using social media now differently than you did a year ago or 2 years ago? And do you anticipate a year from now you'll be doing it even more differently? 800-423-8255. We've got Dara on the line from Waltham. Dara, go ahead.
Yeah, you are criticizing the platform, which are actually very democratic. They're for everybody. But actually, you don't list NPR in those categories, which is actually very non-democratic because it filters everything that it is against Republican Party, white men, President Trump. So which one is better?
Well, Dara, I take your criticism openly. I can tell you that we do not engage in those filters here on Radio Boston, but I do hear your point. And Joan and Kimberly, when you hear Dara right after Joan saying, well, we have to get to the point where we need to curate content, we need to have some rules and standards, there's Dara saying, you know, and maybe I'm paraphrasing or interpreting, I don't like the curation because it doesn't bring the viewpoints that I want forward, and social media is more democratic. Certainly around the election, we've heard that, Kimberly, and that's why we're seeing people move to Parler, which has basically said, hey, listen, no filters, it's your job to curate your own content and do your own fact-checking. We are where you come for truly what they would say is free speech. So what about that?
Yes, listen, they, as I said in the beginning, that's what social media was seen as a very democratizing force in a world where traditional media is not as open. And that was one of the benefits of it. And that still is seen as one of the benefits of it. But you also have this idea that particularly this year, that anything that is turns a critical eye, anything that is truth speaking against the president of the United States in particular, is left leaning. So just telling a true fact can be seen as a leftward bias, which isn't always true. Certainly some media organizations do have biases, but to call social media that when you open it up and then turn it around and say, well, no, it's biased against certain individuals. We need to go find our own space that doesn't have that bias. It doesn't always ring completely true, but it's certainly the idea behind Parler and these other forms of media that are more likely to appeal to folks on the right. It just shows how divisions within a society can perpetuate themselves in whatever medium is available, including social media.
Joan, a few years ago when I was teaching social work, we were just beginning to explore whether Facebook was a place that made people more lonely or more depressed based on research that was coming out, or gave people a chance to find their people when they might not in their particular geographic community, let's say. Where today does the research land on whether, on balance, social media platforms are healthy for communities and people or not?
So I've been taking a deep dive into medical misinformation since the beginning of the pandemic. And the way in which people are being targeted by medical misinformation, grifts, scams, hoaxes, is not by virtue of the fact that popular information rises to the top. There's people out there with specific budgets and strategies for reaching into networks of people who are seeking information, vulnerable people who are, for instance, seeking information about the pandemic and are looking to buy masks, for instance. We remember that that rush. Those moments are what make people very, very vulnerable to misinformation, especially as Facebook has decided in some instances that they were going to allow targeted advertising and then they weren't going to allow it. And so we've seen these companies really waffle when journalists go out and find the evidence to say these are causing widespread public harms. We have all kinds of rules.
Joan, we're going to run out of time, so I'm not cutting you off, but I need you to wrap that up.
Yeah, well, I'm just saying that essentially that we do know that some aspects of these platforms do contribute to harm in a big way.
All right. Thank you. Sorry to cut it short there, Joan, but the show
does. It's all good.
We just were going to run out of time. Joan Donovan, Research Director of the Shorenstein Center, and Kimberly Atkins, Senior Opinion Writer at the Boston Globe. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll do more Year in Review this week, listeners. Thanks for listening and engaging today. That's our show. I'm Tiziana Deering. Tune in again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.